It's Central Time. I'm Rob Farage. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, we'll hear about a new effort by the governor to close what's called the dark store loophole. First, bread has been a cornerstone of the human diet for thousands of years. Pretty much every culture has mixed the basic ingredients, the ground grain, water, and salt, then with time to allow wild yeast to ferment and leaven the dough. Baked bread shows up in ancient Egyptian hieroglyphics, and evidence of bread more than 14,000 years old was discovered in Jordan last year. But while bread is a staple and has played a big role in human history, it can be a little intimidating to make at home. On this week's Food Friday, our guest talks about the best and easiest ways to make delicious bread at home. Ken Forkish is a baker, restaurateur, and author of two cookbooks dedicated to making bread and pizza, including the book Flour, Water, Salt, Yeast. Ken, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Nice to be here, Rob. Thanks for having me.
Well, why do you think some people, I'll include myself in this, are a little intimidated by bread making?
I'm not sure. Maybe you can tell me why you find it intimidating.
Well, I don't know. It seems like there's so much that can go wrong, right? It's like, even with a good recipe, it's like out of my control.
That's the story of life, man. you know, but I think that's probably true for a lot of people where doing something they haven't done before, until you tried it, there's always this like doorway that you need to walk through that as a mental construct. But I tried to, in Flour, Water, Salt, Yeast, I tried to describe, it's not just a recipe book. It's really also, it's a book about methodology, not in a hard way. I tried to write so it would be interesting and, you know, enjoyable reading. But if I was just a recipe book, then I wouldn't be teaching. And my goal with this book was to teach you how to make bread so that it was something that you could enjoy, get really good results in, and then want to replicate it and do it as part of your regular life schedule.
What are some of the things that where people go wrong? They've got a fine recipe, but the bread just doesn't come out right. What are a couple of the usual culprits?
Well, not giving it enough time. And when I started working on my book and looking at bread books that had been written previously, most of them called for bread dough that would be mixed and then ready to bake your loaves in a couple of hours. And while you can do that, it takes a lot of yeast, and often they would use sugar to accelerate the fermentation. But it would not be a very interesting bread to eat. And as a craft baker, my bakery, Ken's Artisan Bakery here in Portland, Oregon, I tried to translate the methods that we use in my bakery to something that would work very well in the home kitchen. And one of the critical ingredients is thyme. And so that's going to be a big distinguisher is between my recipes and those that were more traditional in American baking. I'm not the first one to use thyme, but I find that if you can have a recipe that uses amount of time to really develop the flavor and the texture and the character of the bread, then you're going to get much better results and you're going to want to repeat it.
And your cookbook title, Flour, Water, Salt, Yeast. I want to peek at a couple of the ingredients here. And I want to talk about the water. I watched a video you did online about getting the water to the right temperature. Why is that so important?
Because if you think of time and temperature as ingredients, the temperature of the dough that you mix will affect the rate at which the dough progresses. And without making this sound complicated, because it's really not, I think it helps if you think of bread baking as a fermentation craft. And essentially, if you mix a dough that you need to rise for, well, in my books, 6 hours or more, it will only get to that spot if the dough is at the right temperature. If you mix it too cold, then the dough is going to move a lot slower. If you mix it too hot, the dough is going to move too fast. So it's a little bit Goldilocks. And I never thought about doing a video on, this is on YouTube, I've got a set of videos that support the recipes in the book. I never even thought about doing a video on how to get the water temperature right, because to me, I've been doing it for so many years, it seemed really easy. But I had a relative say, hey, I'm really intimidated by getting the water temperature. I go, oh, okay, well, it's really easy, but I'll do a video, you know? And for any of the listeners, you know, if you want to get water at, let's say, 90 degrees Fahrenheit, you pour warm water into a container, and you measure their temperature. It's just a little $10 probe thermometer. And if the temperature is a little bit too warm, you add some cold water until you get it right. If it's a little too cold, you add warm water until you get it right. And it sounds simple and obvious, but for some people that was sort of a challenge.
And did I see, I don't remember if it was in your video or someone somewhere else, in municipal water systems where the water is treated with chlorine, you want to let the water sit for a while, let that chlorine evaporate, is that right?
Ugh, do you even want to drink it?
But if it's the water you got.
Yeah, totally. It's true. Hopefully the chlorine level is not too high. If it is, it's going to negatively affect your dose. Not going to work very well. How do you deal with that? I don't remember. I know there are products you can buy that remove those things from the water. Maybe it's just time. You let it sit out. You know?
I don't. No. I thought I'd read that somewhere, but I'm not sure.
I didn't write it in my book. I don't know the technique, but I remember I using like a swimming pool test kit to see what if there was chlorine in my water. And one time there wasn't, and another time there was. And so I think it is part of municipal water systems to periodically apply chlorine, but it may not be consistent from week to week.
Talking to Ken Forkish, baker, restaurateur, and cookbook author. His books include flour, water, salt, yeast. He's giving us the basics of making great bread and some pizza crusts, too, while we're at it. We've got some recipes from him at WPR.org/Food Friday. We asked our listeners on the Ideas Network Facebook page what their advice was on baking bread. We heard from Jacqueline, and Jacqueline says, weigh your ingredients. And Ken, I've heard this. Why is it important that we weigh as just opposed to measuring by volume?
Well, if you want consistent, good quality results, you'll get much more accurate measurements by weight than you will with volume. My cup of flour is going to weigh different than your cup of flour. My tablespoon of salt is going to be different than your tablespoon of salt. And my three cups of water are going to be, you know, so every single ingredient is going to be measured more accurately. And in my book, I provide my recipes were based on metric ingredients, and it's not hard. It's a $20 scale that you can buy easily online or at a kitchenware store. And you just put an empty container on the scale, you press a zero button, and then you put the ingredient on into the container until you hit the required amount. It's not hard at all. And so it's good that you get used to using a kitchen scale. You'll get better results, period.
Now, we can buy yeast at stores. We can also create our own, right? Not really create our own, but take advantage of what's in our environment. How do we do that?
Yeah, and that's really the historic way of making breads up until the last 100 years. There is yeast everywhere. It's in soil. It's in the skins of fruits. It's in most flour that you buy. And it's in the air. You can't see it, but it's present everywhere. Yeast is pretty amazing. And if you just mix like a good organic whole wheat flour and warm water in pretty much equal amounts, so you get sort of a slurry in a container, and if you just let it sit out for a day, you'll see a little bit of gas in there. And then what I have you do is you throw half of it away and you add more flour and water, mix it up, and just let it sit out. After 48 hours, you've got a very lively, bubbly mess. And then continued feeding, you toss, you add more flour and water. On a 6 or 7 day schedule, then you finally have a sourdough culture, or in French called levain, culture that you can use to leaven your bread without buying yeast at all. And it's pretty cool, and it has creates a really nice flavor for the bread, and it's kind of cool.
Is a bread made with a yeast in, I don't know, your kitchen in Portland going to be different than what I make here in Madison, because our yeast dudes are different?
You know, yeast dudes, if all other variables are exactly the same, you know, your temperatures, the flour you use, the water, it's going to be, I'm guessing, really hard to tell the difference. The primary microflora are going to be the same. There's going to be some difference, but it's not going to be white and black. It's going to be very close.
We're talking to Ken Forkish right now. He's a baker, a restaurateur, and author of the book Flour, Water, Salt, Yeast. He's with us on this week's edition of Food Friday to talk about bread making, and we'll get a little pizza crust in there in a minute, too. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What questions do you have about baking bread? Did you start making it maybe after being intimidated by the concept of baking bread? How did it go? What got you over the hump there? What are some of your favorite recipes for baking bread. Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or you can join in on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. It's Food Friday. We continue our conversation about bread with Ken Forkish. He's a baker, restaurateur, and author of two cookbooks dedicated to making bread and pizza, including the book Flour, Water, Salt, Yeast. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What do you want to know about bread baking? Do you have a problem in your bread making and you need a solution? You have a question for our guest, or do you want to share one of your bread or pizza baking triumphs with us? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Find some recipes from our guest at WPR.org/Food Friday. Let's go to Marie now in Barneveld. Marie, hi.
Hi, how you doing?
Good. What did you want to bring up, Marie?
So what I think has been really fun is my best friends down out in Ridgeway, Wisconsin, which is just west of Madison. They're called Meadowlark Organics, and they are a farm-to-flour farm. And so they grow small grains, and they have it all milled locally in Lone Rock, Wisconsin, and you can buy their flour around town. And I never baked bread until I met Hallie and John. And then ever since then, I've been experimenting because it's like I know the flour is grown 5 miles from my door, which is just so cool. So I would say, you know, if people can use, you know, their local grains and try to create kind of a local grain economy and just experimenting with bread, it's not that bad. It would really help out farms, definitely.
Marie, thanks a lot for the call. And Ken, that reminds me, I think when you started your research for your pizza book, you went to Naples and found the origins of pizza using, just like Marie does now, local flours and other ingredients. How much do you try to do that in your own work?
Oh, absolutely. We use Pacific Northwest flour at my at both of my bakeries and my pizzerias. Some of it is extremely local, and some of it is in the Oregon, Washington area. There's Camas Country Mill down in Eugene, Oregon. It's about a two-hour drive away. They make really fantastic flour from specific varieties of wheat and spelt and kamut that are grown not just they're grown instead of growing for yield, which is the habit of traditional commercial agriculture. They're growing basically for baking characteristics and flavor. And we're just getting some fantastic flour. It makes a huge difference. And I completely agree with what your caller Marie had to say, which is seek out local flours. You'll be greatly rewarded.
Thanks a lot for the call, Marie. We'll go to Nancy in Wanakee now. Nancy, hi.
Hi. How are you guys today?
Good. What do you want to tell us about, Nancy?
Good. Well, I learned to bake bread from my mother, who learned from her grandmother. And, of course, when I bake a batch, I only know how to make 8 loaves, because that's all they ever made. But so when my dad was having some cardiac issues, they changed the oil out from lard to olive oil, which it was good. But one day when I made my last batch, I was out of olive oil, so I used butter, which, again, is good, but the texture difference is just so different. Why? It's really my big question.
Nancy, thanks for the call. So using different fats, basically, in different kinds of bread, Ken.
Yeah, I mean, different fats, they just have different properties, and they're going to act and taste different. The reason my book was titled Flour, Water, Salt, Yeast, Nancy, is that those are the core ingredients that you need to make bread, and you can make really outstanding bread without using any fats at all. And I encourage you to give it a try. It won't be the exact same recipe you've been using, but you can get very, not only great bread, because all the breads I make are just those ingredients, and the variables are, well, which kind of flour am I using? Am I using whole wheat flour? Am I using white flour? Am I using rye flour or spelt flour and others? And you can get really excellent bread without putting any fat in it, and that might in some ways be better voice.
Nancy, thanks a lot for calling. If you've got, you know, extra loaves and you're making 8 at a time, drop them by the studio. We can always use some bread. I'll go to Kristen now in Madison. Kristen, hello.
Hello. Question for you. I received recently got into sourdough baking thanks to one of my friends, and I've had a good time making some plain sourdoughs. But now I really would like specifically to get into adding in some ingredients like garlic, but I just don't quite know, should I cook some beforehand? When do I mix it in into the process? Just kind of confused of when the best time is to add it in without stunting its growth.
So there's two things you need to think about. One is the type of ingredient that you're going to add. And then the second thing is, at what stage do you add it? And to answer the second question first, wait until your dough is completely mixed so you get the proper gluten development. And then you fold in and mix only until it's incorporated in the dough, whatever your added ingredient is. It might be raisins. It might be nuts. If it's something like garlic, I'd be really careful about adding raw garlic to a bread dough. It's going to be really powerful. Roasting it, then sure, you might get it'll be a lot mellower. Then you want to think about the size of the ingredients. So let's say you're putting in apples. If you put in chunks that are too large, keep in mind there's a lot of moisture within that kind of addition of ingredient, and so it's going to create big pockets around the fruit. So I like to go for a pretty small dice or chop on anything I'm adding to a bread.
Kristen, thanks for calling. Hope that helps. We're talking to Ken Forkish on this edition of Food Friday. He's a baker. He's giving us advice and encouragement to get started on bread making. His books include flour, water, salt, yeast. Ken, I promise some pizza. We've got a recipe at WPR.org/Food Friday for a pizza crust and I think the margarita pizza. What are the basics to making a really good pizza dough?
Well, it's like my bread toasts. Think of time as the most important ingredient. And you can't make a good pizza dough or a good bread dough in 2 hours. The nice news is that for either one of these things, it's not very much active time. It's elapsed time where you can be doing other things. The rest of the question, I forgot.
Oh, that was the basics. But so how long do we have to let that pizza dough rise? Is it that six-hour-ish mark like you were talking about with some of the breads?
It depends. In my book, The Elements of Pizza, I have a variety of pizza dough recipes that vary based on schedule, recognizing that if it's a Saturday or a Sunday, then you probably want to mix a dough in the morning and have bread ready for dinner that night, or pizza, either one. So on those doughs, it's 6 or 7 hours or 8 hours of fermentation time. But let's say it's a Tuesday night and you want pizza on Wednesday night for dinner, you can... I have a different recipe where you mix a dough, and then a little while later, you make up your dough balls. You put them in the refrigerator, and then the next day when you get home from work, you pull them out of the refrigerator, and as they warm up, you preheat your oven, and an hour later, you're making pizza. So the schedules, you manipulate time and other ingredients so that you can have some variety in your schedule so you can do this and make it work within your, you know, day-to-day life.
Let's go back to our callers now. John is with us in Middleton. John, hi.
Well, hi. I'm an older wannabe baker because I've done a lot of other kinds of cooking, but I find myself starting to use yeast and have tried to make bread and have tried to make rolls. And it seems to me that the interior of the rolls are harder than I would like. It's not soft. I like to have the outside hard and the inside soft. What am I doing wrong?
John, thanks. Ken, any thoughts?
You know, it's hard to, like, give you one thing without really knowing the recipe and so forth. But I think you might just want more moisture content in your dough. And if you're hydrating it with water or water and milk, I'd put some more liquid in your dough and see how that works out for you.
All right, John, good luck. Let us know how that works out. So Ken, say, okay, we've done it. We've made some of our good basic loaves. What's a more challenging one that we could then graduate onto?
Well, in my book, Flour, Water, Salt, Yeast, I start you out with the simplest of doughs. It still makes a very good bread, and I call it the Saturday dough. And then it graduates into those that have a little bit more complexity to both their flavor and the process. There's something that's called a pre-fermented dough that we use in a good bakery. In my bakery, we use something that's called a poulish for our baguettes. So out of the total flour, we pre-ferment about 35% of it. It's an equal mix of flour and water and a little bit of yeast. And it ferments overnight for about 12 hours. And then in the morning, it's this beautiful bubbly mass. And we then add that to more flour, water, and salt and a little bit of yeast for the final dough mix. So the total bread dough has two separate mixes before it's completed. And you get more complexity of flavor. It's beautiful. Our baguettes made with the poulet, they have this nice sort of buttery flavor to them when the ingredients are still just flour, water, salt, and yeast. And then it progresses to the most complex recipes, use the natural Levant culture that you build up and then feed regularly to maintain. And the breads made from those are very rewarding. They have just a beautiful complexity of flavor.
Oh, and I wanted to ask, hand kneading versus using a mixer. For the home baker, what's your favorite way to go?
My favorite way to go is mixing by hand. And I do this for both bread doughs and pizza doughs. None of the recipes in my books even use a mixer. There's less equipment to worry about, but it's also, you get this, once you do it repeatedly, you get this familiarity with the dough because of the contact you have with it. And so your hands will start to understand if, see, maybe there's not quite enough water in the dough, or maybe this dough is a little bit too much water, maybe, you know, something's a little, you'll know if it's right or not. Just by the way it feels to your hands.
Ken, thanks a lot for joining us. It's been a lot of fun.
Yeah, I really enjoyed it. Thanks for having me on your show.
That's Ken Forkish, baker, restaurateur, and author of two cookbooks dedicated to baking bread and pizza, titled Flour, Water, Salt, Yeast, and the Elements of Pizza. He joined us on this week's Food Friday to talk about baking at home. You can find recipes online. There's a bread up there and a pizza at wpr.org/foodfriday. Coming up after the news, Governor Tony Evers says he'll try to close something often called the dark store loophole. It affects local property taxes. He's looking to do that in his first proposed state budget. We'll get the details coming up. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. Governor Tony Evers says his first budget will have language closing what's often called the dark store loophole. It's part of a state tax law that lets a business challenge how much they're valued at and by extension how much money they pay in local taxes. Local governments say this puts a growing tax burden on homeowners in their communities and means they have to pay expensive legal costs when businesses bring their cases to court. Here's Jerry DeShane, executive director of the Wisconsin League of Municipalities, talking on Wisconsin Eye.
This is two loopholes in Wisconsin property tax assessment law that is allowing large properties, particularly commercial properties, to have their assessments reduced well below what it cost them to build their buildings. What a common man would say, oh, that building is a $10 million building. No, these dark store loopholes allow them to get that assessment shaved in half or less. And the way assessment law works in Wisconsin, that tax burden just gets shifted to everybody else. It's an issue of fairness.
But retailers and business groups disagree, saying efforts to make changes to state tax law are just an attempt to legalize tax hikes on businesses. Here's Scott Manley, Senior Vice President of Government Relations at Wisconsin Manufacturers and Commerce, making the case before a state Senate committee 2 years ago.
We've heard the word loophole used a lot today. There's no such thing as a dark store loophole. We have Wisconsin tax law, assessment law, and the assessment manual. And really what this legislation is an effort to legalize what has been, for the past 10 years or so, an unlawful assessment practice.
Brianna O'Reilly joins us now, reporter for WisPolitics, covering this story. Brianna, thanks for joining us.
Yeah, thank you, Rob, for having me.
What do people mean when they call this the dark store loophole? How does that work on a practical level?
Yeah, that's a great question. So basically the, you know, so-called loophole allows big box retailers to lower their property tax assessments. Under this practice, these stores, a good example is Menards, you know, they're able to base their tax assessments on the value of vacant stores. And then that practice, opponents have argued, reduces the retailer's property tax assessment and shifts the tax burden then to, you know, residential homeowners and small businesses.
And a lot of this traces back to a state Supreme Court case back 10 plus years ago or so. What happened there that kind of opened the door to this?
Yeah, that's right. That case from 2008, I believe, it was Walgreens versus the City of Madison. It basically changed how assessors assess the taxable value of a business, and, you know, it's usually a retail building in this case. So basically the court ruled that that property tax assessments for leased retail property must be based on similar property rather than, you know, what's paid to lease the property itself. And this decision, you know, back before 2008, assessors could base the taxable value off of those retail buildings off of a formula that factored in the property's use and building costs.
This has been an argument for a while now between cities and business groups. Have we seen efforts in the legislature before this year?
Yeah, actually, last session there was a really big bipartisan push that, you know, there was a lot of activity, especially in 2018, the latter part of the session, but lawmakers were ultimately unable to get a deal through with the legislature. There was a really dramatic evening, actually, in the Assembly back in February of 18, where lawmakers tried putting a substitute amendment into the Kimberly-Clark incentive package bill, but they ultimately just couldn't get it done.
What are we hearing from Governor Evers now?
Well, so this week, he told the county's association during a stop in Madison that his budget will include a provision to close this loophole, but he didn't offer specifics about how he'd go about doing that. But after the speech, he, you know, was talking to reporters, and he said he was planning to include a small amount of money in his budget to address the issue. You know, but again, we don't have details at this point of what that might look like. So at this point, we're just waiting for the end of the month when the governor will officially introduce his budget to see what's really in there.
Are local governments still assessing businesses the old way and then just waiting to see if they get hit with a lawsuit?
So actually, there was this great study from the I think the Wisconsin Policy Forum did a recent report that kind of looked at the appeals that municipalities have been facing from big box stores looking to lower their tax bills following these assessment practices. And I have it in front of me here. It looks like that survey found local officials reported 79 appeals from retailers to lower their property tax assessments in 2017. And that was up from 63 in 2016 and 66 in 2015. So, yeah, one of the big arguments that we heard when this bill was being considered, these two bills that were being considered last session, is, you know, municipalities, local governments are losing a lot of money trying to defend their assessments in court.
Talking to Brianna Riley from WisPolitics about the so-called dark store loophole possibly on the way out under a government or under a budget proposal from Governor Tony Evers, as we're hearing. Still no details on that yet. Brianna, this comes this year after a bunch of referenda, right, around the state. What happened?
Yeah, that's a great question. So we saw pretty overwhelming support from, I think, 17 counties and a handful of municipalities back in November, where residents weighed in and said they want to see lawmakers address this issue and close these so-called loopholes. But these referenda, these questions on the ballot, they're non-binding, so it doesn't compel lawmakers representing those areas to act in one way or another. But, you know, proponents of this kind of legislation are hopeful that it really put the issue on lawmakers' radars, and they're hopeful that the push will continue this session.
Now, business groups, most notably Wisconsin Manufacturers and Commerce, have argued against this idea of ending, they don't really even call it a loophole. What's been their argument against changing things now?
Yeah, so actually, that big business lobby, WMC, they put out a response this week to Governor Evers' statement. I think it was on Tuesday when he talked to the County's Association, and this is actually from Corey Fish, who is the group's director of tax and transportation and legal affairs. But he said basically that the group would oppose any attempt from Evers to change the state's property tax system to allow, I guess, the reflection of income from a business rather than the physical presence of the building. So it looks like this will still face some opposition ahead this session.
Right. The idea is, okay, no, you're, from the business perspective, you're trying to treat us unfairly, whereas a resident of a homeowner would be charged for the land and the structure that they have. The business group is saying you also want to unfairly include the lease we pay, the lease a business pays to control that property. So they say there's a philosophical argument here, too, it sounds like.
Yeah, that's exactly right. I mean, their argument all of last session and still continuing to this day is, you know, they're acting legally, and governments just want to further impose taxes on businesses. And they're saying that businesses are already covering much of that tax burden in communities across the state.
How big a hit do municipalities say they're taking because of these challenges to their assessments?
That's a great question. During the testimony last session, I don't have a full figure in front of me, but there were local government officials that said they were losing in legal fees. I mean, hundreds of thousands of dollars trying to defend these in court. So, honestly, the full number, especially across the state, is much higher than that. But it really does vary municipality to municipality.
As you said, the next shoe to drop here is the actual budget plan from Governor Evers. Do we have a timeline on when we expect that?
Yeah, so he's delivering his budget address February 28th. So the full document will be available then, and we'll be able to really see what's all in there in terms of this dark store loophole and, all of his other priorities too.
Brianna, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Of course. Thank you for your time.
That was Brianna Riley, reporter with WisPolitics. She was with us to talk about what's often called the dark store loophole and its impact on local property taxes. Many of the conversations surrounding opioid drug use have centered on its addictive qualities and the growing number of overdoses attributed to drugs like OxyContin, fentanyl, and heroin. The alarm has led the CDC to issue new prescribing guidelines, and some doctors have started to prescribe these painkillers less frequently, if at all, and some pharmacies have even refused to fill prescriptions. But our next guest says that the overcorrection hurts people living with chronic pain who have relied on opioids as part of their pain management plans for years. Kate Nicholson is a civil rights attorney and a chronic pain awareness advocate. Kate, welcome to Central Time.
It's my pleasure to be here.
Can you first tell us a little bit about your own personal experience dealing with chronic pain?
Sure. I started to have chronic pain in the 1990s. I was sitting at my desk one day working at the Department of Justice when my back started to burn really badly. And pretty quickly, my body seized and knocked me to the floor. And I really couldn't sit or stand or walk for more than very short distances with a walker for about 20 years after that. Turned out that it was related to a surgical injury where they had cut a major nerve plexus, the lumbosacral plexus in my spinal cord. And when the nerves repaired, scar tissue and neuromas formed and really damaged things for me. So I ended up having to learn to adapt to that condition and continue to work and function. And I credit proper pain management. I was treated at multidisciplinary pain clinics that were still widely available in the 1990s. And part of that included treatment with opioid analgesics in addition to other integrated treatments. I credit that appropriate treatment with allowing me to continue to work and function despite those challenges.
And now you've got an experience. I've heard from other people that with this kind of chronic pain, excruciating pain in many cases, day-to-day coping would be next to impossible without some opioid medications. This is a story you've heard not just from yourself, right, but from others.
Absolutely. I especially since I did a TED Talk and it's gone live and I've written some articles, I hear from people almost every day. In fact, I just heard from someone last night on my website who had read my article on the clampdown and who called to sort of thank me for affirming that it can be necessary because his brother had just passed away from either, they weren't clear yet whether it was suicide or an overdose, but he had broken his back really badly. He had taken opioids for years and in the last year had been taken off of them and was really struggling with suicidal ideation and the need to get some sort of pain relief. So opioids can be necessary and appropriate for some patients, even some patients with chronic pain. They were certainly too liberally prescribed for a long time for all kinds of pain, and that created some problems that we see today. But the corrective right now, you know, we've gone sort of from one really broad pendulum swing to another, and it's claiming victims on both sides of that swing. And today, a lot of the victims are people in serious pain who are being denied appropriate medication.
Kate Nicholson is with us, civil rights attorney, chronic pain awareness advocate. She says in the midst of concerns over opioid addiction, there's been an overreaction. It's keeping chronic pain patients from getting medications they need. Kate, you talked about that clampdown. And where is this coming from? Is this from law enforcement? Is this from individual doctors or pharmacists worried that, hey, am I contributing to this opioid epidemic?
I think it's coming from a lot of things. I mean, certainly a lot of the media coverage has focused on prescribing and the role of prescribing, and in a way that I think is confusing to people. The data on all of these things, opioid mortality, isn't great, but what we do know from a lot of the data is that most of the people who misuse opioids, which is the behavior that's most likely to lead to addiction or overdose, were not given them under the care of a doctor. All of our studies on drug and alcohol use, national surveys, show that most of those people bought them on the street or took them from medicine cabinets. So there's this confusion that people who are under the supervision of a doctor are the people who are dying on the streets. There's also confusion of even among clinicians about the difference between dependence and addiction. Anyone who takes opioids for a period of time is likely to become dependent, and that really means that if you take someone off abruptly, they're going to have side effects. Something like that can happen with other kinds of medication as well, like beta blockers or antidepressants, but that's very different from addiction, which is the sort of compulsive use of a substance despite negative life consequences. Appropriate medical use is just the opposite. It's use on a set schedule at a set dose under a doctor's supervision with, if it's used appropriately, with life-restoring consequences. And the FDA director, though, Scott Gottlieb, just had to come out publicly very recently and explain the difference between those things and explain that just because someone's taking an opioid for pain and develops dependence, or because someone is taking an opioid for an opioid use disorder for with medication-assisted treatment, that does not mean that they are addicted. That is not a dangerous thing. They're taking medication like any other person is taking medication appropriately. But there's a lot of confusion. There's a lot of inflammation in the media. And then recently, there have been a lot of laws and mandatory policies that have come out. Some of them stem from guidance that came out in 2016 that was issued by the CDC. And much of what is in the CDC's guidelines is quite well accepted by everyone, that opioids should be used not as a first line of treatment or a second line of treatment, that they should be used for the shortest period of time at the lowest appropriate, you know, possible dose. And I think most people really do agree with that. There were guidelines issued for primary care physicians, not for specialists, and again, were issued as guidance. But there were a few provisions in those guidelines that have been, in the minds of many, weaponized or turned into laws and mandatory policies. Most of the state legislatures have adopted parts of the guidelines as laws, and those guidelines were not model legislation. They were not intended to become legislation. A lot of major pharmacy companies like Walgreens and CVS have adopted policies that are providing oversight and denying people fills for opioids at a certain dosage or for a certain duration. Insurers are refusing to cover opioids. Some state Medicaid programs are also doing that at a certain dose or for a certain duration. And so there are just all of these levels of oversight. And in addition to that, you have sort of drug enforcement agency and some doctors who are being sort of targeted because of the dosages that they prescribe. In fact, I think that just happened in Wisconsin. I saw a press release from the Department of Justice that letters had been sent, although I haven't seen the letters themselves, but I saw the press release, that letters had been sent to physicians who are prescribing at a certain dose range, warning them against doing so. So there are all of these layers of oversight right now that are really having a chilling effect. And the result is that people are being tapered off of their opioids. They're being abandoned in cure altogether. A lot of people with chronic pain, even those who don't use opioids, aren't able to find doctors who are willing to treat them at all. You know, the American Medical Association recently came out against this sort of use of or misuse of the CDC guideline. They opened their interim meeting with a conversation. One of the physicians, the president of the AMA, is a cancer doctor, and she told the story of one of her patients who had prostate cancer that had spread to his bones and was in severe pain. She had prescribed an opioid for him for that pain. He went to try and fill it at the pharmacy. Pharmacy denied it, accused him of being a drug seeker. And so he went home feeling very ashamed and then tried to kill himself. Mm. So it is a serious problem. It's a real problem. And we really need to find a way to moderate this conversation so that we are not overprescribing, but we're not underprescribing either.
And Kate, do you see a stigma now being attached to pain patients?
Absolutely. I mean, there has always been a stigma, I think, attached to pain. A lot of people don't really understand the difference between acute pain and chronic pain. You know, most of us experience acute pain, and that's a normal body function that warns us that something is wrong, and that we need to seek medical attention or rest. But when pain becomes chronic, it actually sort of can change from being protective to damaging the body. People with, you know, chronic pain have a lower lifespan, significantly higher rates of disability, impaired quality of life. In fact, there was a study that showed that the quality of life of someone in moderate to severe persistent pain is equal to someone who is dying of cancer. So I think there are a lot of misperceptions about pain. We have historic ideas that pain should be borne, that it's transformative, that it's good for us. Those come from our religious history. In fact, we didn't use anesthesia widely for a long time for that reason. So there are already a lot of stigmas and misunderstandings about pain. And in this current crisis, those have just become very exaggerated. Pain patients are seen as drug seekers and liabilities, really. I mean, that's really what's happening with physicians. Not like they want to drop their patients, but they're concerned about liability. And in some senses, pain patients are also seen as sort of the residue of the shame of overprescribing and the deaths that we see. So yes, I'm seeing a huge increase in stigma, and there's the good medical evidence that stigma can really disproportionately impact care and overall health as well.
We'll leave it there for now. Kate, thanks for joining us today.
That's my pleasure.
We've been talking to Kate Nicholson, civil rights attorney and a chronic pain awareness advocate. She shared her own experience and that of others. She says a crackdown on opioids is hurting people suffering from chronic pain. You can follow our continuing coverage here on Central Time on the Ideas Network and WPR News Team. You can find all of that over at WPR.org. Coming up in just a bit, fewer students in Wisconsin, college students, are going into the teaching profession, and more teachers are leaving the field. We'll talk with a WPR reporter about what's driving that trend, how schools are trying to keep up and keep teachers in the classrooms, and a new plan, a response from the UW system trying to bring more people into the teaching profession. You can share your own experiences if you're a teacher yourself, a parent watching a teacher shortage at your school, if you work in a school system. Tell us what you're seeing as far as people going into and or leaving the teaching profession, and whether your district is having trouble keeping teachers on the job. You can email ideas@WPR.org or tweet us at Central Time WPR. You may have heard over the last week or so some loud booming noises and wondered what was that. I think a lot of weather stations and TV stations, newspapers are getting calls from people hearing this weird boom. It's a frost quake, quite possibly. I haven't heard it myself, but producer Jay Carlisle Larson is in here. You heard some of this?
I did. I was sitting at home last night and just, you know, eating dinner, and suddenly heard this big boom out of nowhere and kind of just sat down and ignored it and was like, I'm going to wait for sirens just in case. I don't want to take it too seriously. Uh-huh. But it was alarming but also kind of cool to see other people being like, did you just hear that? Like online and stuff.
Now, I've heard of a couple different things. One coming from the ground, one from, I guess, people's buildings itself. Yeah. What did it feel like for yours?
To me, it seemed like it was outside of the building. I basically live in a fortress that has withstood the test of time. So I was like cozy. I'm not too worried. Knock on wood. I don't want anything to happen to where I live. But yeah, it seemed like it was outside and it was very loud.
So we've had these before in Wisconsin. It's a frost quake when the ground gets saturated, like it was raining a lot yesterday, then freezes quickly. So that water freezes, expands, and then the ground's got to do something. So you get this loud frost quake.
And I do think that yesterday was kind of the perfect way for that to happen.
It was frost quake, perfect storm, definitely. Let us know if you felt one. Email ideas@WPR.org. This is Central Time.